From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. One of the industries up in the air in the digital information era is books, and the trends are still shaking out. If you're a bookseller, it's good and bad. Games and apps and other technical gadgets continue to be serious competition, of course. Prices for paper books are expected to come down as e-books continue to take hold. But industry observers are also predicting a backlash away from the distractions of social media. We're seeing more book clubs and reading groups. And get this, the number of independent bookstores actually went up over the last year. Not by a lot, but enough to suggest local bookshops are going to weather the storm. People still want to read, especially this time of year. Today in the program, we've gathered our group of experts from Salt Lake City's local bookstores to offer suggestions for something to read on vacation. We'll get started right after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Like a lot of industries, booksellers gather from time to time for expos and conventions where they can check out the new technology as well as the competition and take the pulse of the new business generally. Independent booksellers gathered in New York last week for the Book Expo America convention, where it was reported that the number of these local booksellers is growing from just more than 1,800 last year to 1,900 this year. Now, it's not explosive growth, but in the uncertainty of the information age and in this economy, at least the arrow is pointing upward. Today in the program, we've gathered our panel of experts from some of Salt Lake City's local bookstores. They're here to make recommendations for books to read during the vacation season. You can join us online if you like with your own suggestions. You can call 801-585-WEST, our email address radiowest@kuer.org. Catherine Weller is back with us, the new book buyer for Weller Bookworks. I need to get used to saying that, and I will.
Weird, huh?
It's at Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. Welcome.
Thank you,
Doug.
Thanks
for being with us. Betsy Burton owns the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake City. Betsy, welcome back.
Thank you, Doug.
And Ken Sanders is back with us, the owner of Ken Sanders Rare Books in downtown Salt Lake on 2nd East. And Ken, welcome back to you.
Always a pleasure, Doug.
So I am interested in just how it's going. I don't even know how to put the question exactly, but what are you guys finding, what people are reading, how things are going generally? Ken, start with you.
Doug, books are alive. Books are real. Books are interactive. They're the most ultimately interactive reading device we've ever had. They're totally hands-on. And as you alluded to in the intro, I think the whole fallout from the digital fallout, the e-book, whatever you want to call it, I think that shedding is largely over, and I think the book world is stabilizing again. Mm-hmm. It's still an unknown future, but what I mean by books are alive is I've got parents with young children coming in, and these kids the young ones are clearly book lovers. Kent and Katie that work for me have a six, seven, 8-month-old Juniper who comes to work every day with her mother. And I've seen to it that I spend a lot of time with Juniper, and she is a book lover. Hmm. She literally devours them, Doug. And just one last thought. Yeah. Older kids that are coming in, I'm astonished by these 8 to 10-year-olds that are reading on their own and how sophisticated their tastes are and how demanding their taste is. I certainly wasn't at that level as an 8 or 9 or 10-year-old.
Hmm. I don't believe that somehow, but Betsy, what do you think? Are you feeling like things are settling in a bit?
I not only think they're settling in, I think they're really good right now. You know, the mood at BEA was very positive. Stores all over the country are up 10 and 12%.
Yeah.
And business is up in our store, and people are more and more eager for not just books, but events too. They just want to be immersed in the book world. And the people that are buying ebooks are also buying hardback books.
Yeah.
So, you know, the fallout, when you think about it, is that they seem to be reading more altogether, and the sales of books in print are not going down, they're going up.
Really?
Yep.
That's good news. Catherine, what are you finding?
It was very positive in New York this year. It was one of the most positive BEAs I've been at in a long time. There was a lot of energy there, a lot of energy amongst the youngsters, which one is used to. Of course, they have a lot of energy. They're 20. But a lot of energy amongst the veterans who can be a little more jaded sometimes. Yeah. So it was really nice. It was across the board. Lots of reports, like Betsy said, of people being up. And indeed reports of, and we've seen this, I think, in all of us in our own stores, the sections that we had seen declining, such as hardcover fiction, for a while now are rebounding, probably partly because the lists are much stronger than they have been, and because people are reading actual physical books again. It's interesting. The e-reader person, for the most part, does seem to be omnivorous. They are still reading print and reading electronic. And so as long as people have their technophilia, but they still want to see something in their hands, mm-hmm. feel something mm-hmm. in their hands, I think we've got a really strong future. And I don't see that ending, because I look at the 20-somethings, the hipsters, they're buying vinyl.
It's true.
Is the ultimate hipster tool, your skinny jeans and your books.
Yeah.
So it's we're still out there, and it's a really good feeling.
Yeah, it is.
I want to jump to the lists, of course, but what are people buying right now? What are they seeing anything in particular? Mysteries? What are they interested in right now? Can you tell?
Fiction has made a big rebound this year. I think fiction was sort of flat last year.
Right.
And people just can't wait to get their hands on good fiction this year. And, of course, nonfiction in the political arena is a big deal, because everybody is very involved in the election. I bought a book on the economy because everybody's still concerned about that.
Yeah.
It's kind of across the board, but fiction would be my pick for the thing that people most want to get their hands on.
What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know if it's our location change or if it is that fiction is stronger this year, but our fiction numbers have been up beyond what I projected. Well, I projected they'd be down.
Huh.
So
wow.
they've done very, very well. And some more tweaks in the regionalism, the regional authors, regional writers, those with that local feel. I'm seeing those come up a little bit more, too, which I'm always happy to see.
And one other thing, Ken is totally right about kids' books.
Yeah.
Kids' books are just booming.
Oh, yeah.
Children's poetry, philosophy, and sustainability, Doug. Those are very active categories in our store.
Really? Okay, well, let's get to the particulars then. Betsy, let's start with you.
Well, not the usual thing for me, but I'm going to start with nonfiction, because I wanted to talk about Terry Tempest Williams' book, When Women Were Birds, which is going to be up at the nursing college tomorrow. And I just love this book. I've loved all of her books, but this one is really unique, I think. It centers around the fact that when her mother was dying, she told Terry she was going to leave her journals.
Yeah.
And when Terry, after her mother had died, she had promised not to open them until her mother died. And after her mother died, she did open the journals, and each was blank.
Yeah.
A whole three shelves, I think, of journals, all blank. And she said that it was a kind of death for her. And then now she's the age she was when her mother died, 54. And she goes back, and she decides to really investigate in her mind what this could be saying to her, what message her mother could be leaving, what it meant that her mother didn't fill the journals, because it's typical, I think, for LDS women to journal.
Mm-hmm.
So really these essays are all over the place in the sense that they talk about her mother, they talk about her own life, they talk about the bridge between those lives, they talk about the bridge between spirituality and just life, and each one is unique. Some investigate her past in ways that she's never done before, and some are political, of course, because she's very political. They're about as beautiful as anything I've read in the last decade. They're just exquisite, but they also are very engaged in life, and I frankly couldn't put them down. And then the book itself is such a beautiful thing. The cover is, I don't know if you can see this, but embossed white birds flying across the cover. And when you flip the pages, there are birds flying. It's just an exquisite book all the way around. And for somebody that's as good a writer as Terry is, this is just incredible. Mm. It's just an amazing book, and it's one that really everybody should read, I think.
Wouldn't be the same experience as an e-reader, would it? Seeing
those you couldn't read it would be a desecration to read this
right.
as an e-book.
Right.
And Terry's always been a woman unafraid to take chances.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is just one more example.
Say the title.
When Women Were Birds, 54 Variations on Voice, Terry Tempest Williams. Okay. The next book that I want to talk about is entirely different. It's Paul Krugman, In This Depression Now. I thought it was so timely. I think everybody, you know what, I really hate the fact that the economy is involved in politics, because it isn't about politics, or it shouldn't be. It's about facts. And that's kind of what Krugman tries to do with this book. He tries to pull it out of politics and talk about it as a science. And as a science, of course, his take is that just as in the Great Depression, you have to really up the economy, feed it, and do what the government did during the Depression. And he talks about all the reasons why the urge to economize and sort of hunker down are really going to make the Depression, and he says we are in a Depression, much worse. It's a brilliant book, but it's also – the thing I loved about it, because I'm not good at math, is it's very easy to follow. So you really can educate yourself about what's going on without suffering in the deal. I really loved it, and I think everybody, again, should read this, In This Depression Now by Paul Krugman. Then another book that's very different is Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal by Jeanette Winterson. This is not so new, but I just loved this when I read it, so I had to talk about it. And Jeanette Winterson is a novelist and a very successful one, and she had the most excruciatingly painful upbringing of anybody I've ever heard of. Her mother was a monster, and she was adopted, and her mother used to tell her quite frequently that the devil made them pick the wrong crib. And she used to kick her out of the house at night, and she'd sit on the doorstep all night. She'd lock her in the coal cellar. She was just an ogre. But she's very funny, Jeanette Winterson is. So all of this is kind of done as slapstick, this suffering that she did, which makes it fun to read. Even while you're being horrified, you're laughing. And then she gets to the place where she says, yeah, she was an ogre, but if I hadn't been brought up by this woman, I wouldn't be who I am, which is a very interesting take on a very hard childhood.
Yeah.
So it's a book that I think is good for people who have had troubled childhoods to read. I love her take on the whole thing. Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal, Jeanette Winterson.
Great. Okay. Catherine.
Okay, I have to also plug Why Be Happy. You know, my daughter read that and then read Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, her first novel, which is a fictionalization of her upbringing back to back. And they're wonderful to read next to each other,
wow.
too. So
yeah.
It's very nice that way. I have been thinking about the pilgrim lately, the trekker, the traveler, that person that I think everybody across the world, but perhaps we in the West especially have an affinity for, the one who goes off into the wilderness and suffers bad feet, too heavy packs, terrible food, awful weather. You know, the lists are the same in every book, but the telling and the journey is different in every book. And that's what will make or break a book. And the three I brought with me today I think are absolutely fantastic for that genre. And it's not a new genre. It goes back to, you know, our favorite lost man Everett Ruiz, back to the Christian mystics, and even further back to the Asian mystics. Basho, the great haiku writer, had wonderful descriptions of his travels. And so it's a rich, rich field to revisit, especially in the summer, I think. The first one is called Wild by Cheryl Strayed. This book is just gone wild, actually, and I was very dubious of it at first. I would not read it. I thought, oh my God, no.
Wait, why?
Because I honestly, this is the book that got me back into the travel writing or the trekking idea again. Mm-hmm. Because the idea of going out and trying to find yourself after some terrible things have happened to you can be so hackneyed. Mm. But again, in the telling, it's not necessarily hackneyed. She begins her book with watching her boots soar end over end into a great crevasse down below one of her hiking boots.
Presumably she wasn't in them at the time.
She was not. Well, she had one left. and it is absolutely a charming book. It's really well done. Her personal problems, her mother dying, her divorce, her not figuring out who she is, being too young to be dealing with what she's dealing with. She deals with all of those things with grace. But at the same time, she deals with the great loss of self that happens out in the wilderness in a very beautiful and poetic way that makes the book absolutely captivating. Strangely, Oprah just started a book club again and picked it as her first book. So it can be a bit dicey to get right now, but it's definitely worth a read. She hiked the Pacific Crest Trail, which is a trail that runs from Mexico to Canada along the ridge of the mountains that are in the Pacific. It's a tough trek. It takes months. It takes planning. And she goes all into all that in detail that's really intriguing and interesting, not boring.
Yeah.
So, Wild by Cheryl Strayed. The next is a book by Gideon Lewis Krauss called A Sense of Direction, Pilgrimage for the Restless and Hopeful. This book has been referred to by many as The Boys Eat, Pray, Love, which I think is rather reductionist, overly reductive, in fact, and not fair to either book. Huh. He, too, does three different treks. He begins trekking on the Camino in Spain with his friend Tom Bissell, who has also written very interestingly about this trek, because he's a feckless young man. He doesn't think he's as feckless as he is, but he is just lost, and he knows he's lost. He's in Berlin trying to figure out what to do, but not wanting to commit to doing anything. Mm-hmm. So what he ends up committing to doing is taking a trek. He treks across the Camino, has the same terrible experience as everybody does, but he opens up a little bit more, which is very interesting. Then he decides to trek on a Japanese island, which is a typical Buddhist trek. You're hiking on asphalt. You're staying in either hotels or these kind of shelters for pilgrims. It's not at all like Cheryl Strayed's. This guy had it a lot easier. But he opens up a little more. He learns a little more. And finally, he hikes with his father, who was a rabbi, as was his mother, who came out to him later in life and sort of left the family in many ways. And the author, Gideon, has been trying to figure out how he feels about that and why that happened and what it means for him. Mm. And so he and his brother and his father trek. And he opens up a little more, loses a little more of his self, and again finds himself in the process. Last one is Turn
we'll
Right.
Say that again. Sense of Direction.
Sense of Direction, Gideon Lewis Krauss. Lastly is Turn Right at Machu Picchu by Mark Adams. This is not just Mark's story. This is the story of the founding of Machu Picchu, and it's the story of the Incas as well. So there are three growths and collapses in this book that Mark Adams weaves together. It's out in paperback now, and it's a really captivating read, both for the history and for the personal journeys of Bingham, the founder of Machu Picchu, and of Mark Adams. It's called Turn Right at Machu Picchu.
Great. Ken Sanders.
Well, Doug, I thought it fitting with the recent passing of Ray Bradbury that we do some sort of homage to him today. You know, from his youthful writings in the pulp magazines of the 1930s and 40s to his first short story collection published by Arkham House, Dark Carnival, Ray Bradbury has been a force in the fantasy and science fiction, speculative fiction, futuristic fiction, as it may be called today. And I guess there's an ongoing debate with authors like him, particularly since his passing. Well, is Ray Bradbury just a sci-fi guy or is he a great American novelist? Yeah. Well, I don't want to make the argument to you that Ray Bradbury is Herman Melville or Walt Whitman, but I do think he is a great American novelist, maybe not on that level. But his contributions over 60-some-odd years, you know, are extraordinary. His novel Fahrenheit 451 will, I think, live forever. And, you know, going back to the 60s and 70s, we didn't look for or put out authors like, in those days, I distinctly remember we put authors like Kurt Vonnegut out in the sci-fi shelf. Is there anybody seriously today that would consider Kurt Vonnegut to be a sci-fi writer? I think not. So in the spirit of that, and his books, you know, for me, if we're going to do just a trilogy of his greatest books, for me it's Fahrenheit 451, it's The Martian Chronicles, and it's The Illustrated Man.
Here's Ray Bradbury. You know what I like about this reading? This was read not that long ago as an older man,
right,
reading a book that he wrote when he was a more vibrant man. But I like the contrast. Ray Bradbury reading from his book, Fahrenheit 451.
It wasn't planned at first. Each man had a book he wanted to remember and did. Then, over a period of 20 years or so, we met each other traveling and got the loose network together and set out a plan. The most important single thing we had to pound into ourselves is that we're not important. We mustn't be pedants. We are not to feel superior to anyone else in the world. We're nothing more than dust jackets for books, of no significance otherwise. Some of us live in small towns. Chapter 1 of Thoreau's Walden in Green River. Chapter 2 in Willow Farm, Maine. Why, there's one town in Maryland, only 27 people. No, don't bomb will ever touch that town, is the complete essays of a man named Bertrand Russell. Pick up that town almost and flip the pages, so many pages to a person. And when the war is over someday, some year, the books can be written again. The people will be called in one by one to recite what they know, and we'll set it up in type until another dark age, when we might have to do the whole damn thing over again. But that's the wonderful thing about man. He never gets so discouraged or disgusted that he gives up doing it all over again, because he knows very well it is important and worth the doing.
It's Ray Bradbury. It sounds like he's just saying that.
That's
got to be a credit to his writing.
An old man, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did he have it memorized? I don't know. I don't know if he was reading or not. In the summer of 1970, Doug, I worked for a bookstore in Hollywood Boulevard who Ray Bradbury haunted that bookshop and came in a lot. And I had the privilege of ringing up some cheap paperback book sale to the great man who I was clearly very much in awe of. And I went on to have several other encounters with him over the years that are all very memorable, and I'll never forget them.
Ken Sanders is with us. He owns Ken Sanders Rare Books on 2nd East in Salt Lake City. Betsy Burton here with us also, the King's English Bookshop at 15th and 15th. And Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square. She's also with us. A list of these books mentioned, by the way, is available on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, it's our summer book show. We do this at the beginning of the vacation season, gather our panel of experts from local bookstores, and we go through as many titles as we can get into the hour. We're covering new titles and classics, fiction and non, throwing some children's books in here too, and who knows what else? Always a surprise or two. Ken Sanders is joining us from Ken Sanders Rare Books. Betsy Burton of the King's English Bookshop and Catherine Weller is with us from Weller Bookworks. And Catherine, your turn.
All right, fiction this time. First book is called Under the Harrow by Mark Dunn, the author of the delightful LMNOP. This book is about a closed society of orphans who live in a place called Dingley Dell, which is, who knows, unless you've read the Pickwick Papers or you're a fan of really obscure Monty Python skits, and then you'll know.
Right.
Dingley Dell is a wonderful place, though. It's one of those utopian societies, and this particular utopian society was based upon old Dickens novels and a set of encyclopedias. So it is very Victorian, but it's Victorian with a twist because, of course, these people aren't living in Victorian England. They're living in a closed society in the middle of nowhere, and they're all orphans. So they turn it into their own thing, and they have their own language. It's a society that most people want to stay in happily, but some want to leave, and they do, and they never come back. And why do they never come back? Finally, there are some people that begin exploring the outside world, and they discover that while the outside world is unknown to them, they are not unknown to the outside world. And there are plans for Dingley Dell, which are unfortunate and sad and brutal. So the citizens of Dingley Dell must muster to fight off the upcoming oppression. And they learn guerrilla warfare. They learn survival tactics. They fight their own sort of revolution in there to defend their way of life. It is a charming book. It is absolutely delightful. The characters are lovely. The plotting is fantastic. Mark Dunn is a wonderful fiction writer who really deserves more acclaim than he gets. And I hope people do pick up this book so they can discover him and maybe then pick up Element OP too.
Yeah, that's great too. Under the Harrow. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Under the Harrow by Mark Dunn. Next is The Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller. Of course, I love this book. It's pivoting off of the Iliad. Madeline Miller is a classics scholar. She's studied the Greek classics for many, many years. And when I began reading this book, I thought, wow, this reads like a really good translation of some Greek classic. She has the tone and the pacing and the coloring that was used. She has it down perfectly. It's really a very well done book from just that standpoint alone. The story, though, is a story that a lot of people wonder about. It's the story of Achilles and Patroclus. And one of the questions that you always get asked in your freshman English or your freshman ancient literature class is, why was Achilles so unhinged by the death of Patroclus during the Battle of Troy? Why did it completely undo him? And this book explores the great love that happened as Patroclus and Achilles were growing up and matured into men. It does not shy away from speculations of homosexual love, and in fact, frankly, that's what it is. They were lovers and they were in love with each other. That said, this is not a salacious book. It's not even a fantastical book in that sense. It's just a really well done, well grounded piece of fiction.
What a great idea.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Song of Achilles by Madeline Miller.
And about the fifth one in 2 or 3 years that are deal with the Greek myths and Greek literature, it's very interesting.
It is interesting. And what's really interesting is how we're looking at the Iliad more now. As a postmodern society, we've always loved the Odyssey. And I love the Odyssey because it's about a warrior becoming human, whereas the Iliad is about men becoming warriors.
Yeah, Ransom was.
Yeah.
Well, the Iliad did really well as a translation. It's doing pretty well, right?
Very. Still, the latest translation
is fantastic.
We're
trying to figure out a way to do a show about that.
You should.
Maybe
you should.
Madeline Miller. All right. Okay.
Greatest
good.
Story
I'll make
ever
note
told.
Of that. Yeah.
And lastly, from the memoirs of a non-enemy combatant, the worst thing about this novel is that title, which is impossible to remember or to get out correctly. Alex Gilvary is his name. He's a young novelist out of Brooklyn, I believe. This is a black comedy, and heavens knows I love black comedies, but this one is really well done. This is the story of a Filipino immigrant who comes to America because he loves fashion. He loves women. He loves to design fashion for women. And he stupidly gets sucked into a relationship with a man who is probably, but you never really know, possibly funding terrorist organizations. And this is after 9/11, of course. And so our protagonist gets picked up by Homeland Security and taken to a prison outside of the country and is interrogated endlessly. This book is actually, the device is that the book is his journals that he is invited to keep while he is in prison trying to defend himself. And Gilvary does a really wonderful job of portraying in a humorous but very real fashion, how is it that you defend yourself when the system is set up to presume you guilty, not like in America, not like we're used to? How do you defend yourself when you can't meet your accusers? How do you defend yourself when you don't even know the charges against you? And you're denied counsel. It's a really wonderful book, just as a romp, but as an exploration of what justice should mean, but often can mean these days. Mm. From the memoirs of an enemy, of a non-enemy combatant, Alex Gilvary.
Great, great. Okay, Betsy.
Okay, well, I'm going to start with fiction, too, and my favorite book of the year is Bring Up the Bodies by Hilary Mantel. I just loved Wolf Hall. This is a follow-up, although you absolutely could read it by itself. And you are, again, in the head of Thomas Cromwell, and it is the best place to be. You can't even imagine. I was just sick when I finished both of these books.
Why? Because they were finished? You were done?
Because right? I was done.
Yeah, you wanted more. Okay.
I wanted more. And now I'm going to have to wait 2 or 3 more years for the third one. But you know, in the first book, Mallory was really helping to strengthen the relationship of Boleyn and her place as queen. And in this one, of course, Henry has seen Catherine and has quickly changing his mind. Mm-hmm. And whatever else Thomas Cromwell is or isn't, he is the king's man and he does the king's bidding. So now, obviously, Boleyn is on her way out. The really interesting thing when reading this is we all know the story. So I'm thinking to myself, how can this be gripping when we know exactly what's going to happen?
Yeah, Anne will lose her head.
Anne will lose her head. And we know it's coming. And the other thing about her writing is that she layers in all of this philosophy and history. And, you know, Cromwell is portrayed as such a wise, far-thinking man, and you're in his head thinking these far-thinking thoughts with him, and yet you're gripped the whole time. You can't wait to turn the page and see what's going to happen next. I can't even believe he does that, but he does. And when the reading takes place that we're going to hear, it's near the end, and Anne Boleyn is in the tower, and she's surrounded by her relatives, women who really don't like her and that whom she does not like. And she's asking to get rid of those women. And she's faced with Cromwell and they're talking.
Here's the actor Simon Vance reading from Hilary Mantel's novel, Bring Up the Bodies.
He stands to take his leave. She unnerves him, the wild distress she is keeping in check, holding back but only just. There seems no point in prolonging the business, but he says, "If the king begins a process to nullify your marriage, I may return, to take statements from you." "What?" she says. "That, too? Is it necessary? Murder will not be enough?" He bows and turns away. "No!" She fetches him back. She is on her feet, detaining him, timidly touching his arm, as if it is not her release she wants so much as his good opinion. "You do not believe these stories against me? I know in your heart you do not, Cromwell." It is a long moment. He feels himself on the edge of something unwelcome. Superfluous knowledge. Useless information. He turns, hesitates, and reaches out. Tentative. But then she raises her hands and clasps them at her breast, in the gesture Lady Rochford had showed him. "Ah, Queen Esther," he thinks. "She is not innocent, she can only mimic innocence." His hand drops to his side. He turns away. He knows her for a woman without remorse. He believes she would commit any sin or crime. He believes she is her father's daughter, that never since childhood has she taken any action, coaxed or coerced, that might damage her own interests. But in one gesture, she has damaged them now. She has seen his face change. She steps back, puts her hands around her throat. Like a strangler, she closes them around her own flesh. "I have only a little neck," she says. "It will be the work of a moment."
Wow.
It's really just amazing. And, you know, I've been thinking, why is it so amazing and yet why are you at the same time back? And it's because Cromwell is witnessing history at the same time he's living it, and you're seeing it through those eyes.
Terrific. Well, Bring Up the Bodies, Hilary Mantel. Great. Ken Sanders.
It's the year of the outlaw, Doug. Butch Cassidy lives again. By some curious coincidence, three books have recently come out on Butch Cassidy and his fabled gang. The first one was Last of the Robber's Roost Outlaws, Moab's Bill Tibbetts by Tom McCourt. It's about a lesser-known member of Butch's gang. The Educated Outlaw, The Story of Elsie Lay and of the Wild Bunch by Harvey Murdoch, who was his grandson of the outlaw. And lastly, Bill Bettinson, who is a grandnephew of Butch Cassidy and grandson of Lula Parker Bettinson, Butch's sister, Butch Cassidy, My Uncle, which is, as a young child, Bill listened to his great aunt tell all these stories of his illustrious ancestor, Butch Cassidy, which led to a lifelong fascination with outlaws in general, but especially Butch, great uncle Butch.
Yeah.
So this is his lifelong research and into this famous uncle of his. And he really does a good job with his research, and despite his own opinions that Butch did survive South America and did live on here, he lets the reader form his own conclusions. And the I think a telling thing is that, you know, Lulu, she went to her grave maintaining Butch survived. And privately, she knew where he was and she knows where he's buried. But she went to her grave without revealing where Butch was buried because she just was – she thought the thought abhorrent that someone might come and dig him up. And at the time, no one thought of that seriously. But now, if they knew where Butch was, they'd dig him up in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
Geraldo for sure. And switching gears, this is in the almost not quite yet published category. This is Will Bagley's volume 2 on his American Trails series that he's been doing. It's called With Golden Visions Bright Before Them, Trails to the Mining West, 1849 and 1852. This arguably may be the best book yet written on the California Gold Rush.
Wow.
It's one of his most massively researched books yet. It's part – volume 1 of the Trails series has already been published. They're supposedly – 2 more volumes in this trail series going. I think it's going to be a really important contribution to the history of the American West, and it may be Will Bagley's finest historical work yet.
Wow. Say the title again.
With Golden Visions Bright Before Them. And I'm sure Will could tell us what diary he got that title
from. Yeah, I'm
from.
Sure he can. We'll have him on. I'm sure we will. But when is it available?
Not till September.
Okay.
But I was so excited about it, I couldn't wait.
Well, you teased us, but we can take that. All right. Great. Is that it for now?
Yes.
Terrific. Okay, we'll be back to you in just a moment. Ken Sanders with us of Ken Sanders Rare Books, Betsy Burton from the King's English Bookshop, and Catherine Weller from Weller Bookworks. All of the books that we're talking about today and more, because we won't get to all of them, we never do, will be available on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, it's our summer book show. We've gathered our panel of experts from local bookstores here in Salt Lake City. Go through as many titles as we can. We're on to round 4, I think it is. We have with us Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks, Betsy Burton of the King's English, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books. And Betsy Burton, let's start with you.
Okay, I'm going to talk about some more fiction. All That I Am by Anna Funder is not brand new. It came out in February, but I think it's kind of a perfect summer book. It's both a novel and a bit of a thriller. It takes place – it begins in the Weimar Republic in the early 1900s, and the main characters are all quite left-wing, and Nazism is just nascent, and the left-wing journalists are making fun of Nazis, a thing that they're going to pay for. So you get a real sense for that world. There are four main characters, three voices, and as I'm reading, one of them is Ernst Toller, and I think to myself, you know, I know that person, that he's a real character, and I mean a real person he was. He was a poet and quite famous, and especially for his politics. So I looked in the back just to see, and all of the characters actually were real. And so the book manages, and it also goes backwards and forwards, and the oldest character, who is the photographer, and kind of the narrator, the narrative voice, if there is one, has the wisdom of time and age. So again, like with the Hilary Mantel, I think that you get a kind of witnessing to history through eyes rather than just a straight historical novel that makes it doubly interesting. But the three people are left-wing. They have to flee when the Nazis come to power, and then they go to England. Now, I did not know a lot about what it would be like to be an émigré in England during the war, and it was pretty horrific. You're there completely on the kindness of the government, and if you make the slightest mistake, they can just kick you out, and you'll end up back in Germany. They're all terrified, and the Nazis are there in force behaving like thugs. So they're actually in danger the entire time they're there, which is why it reads like a thriller. And the back and forthness between the Weimar Republic and then England, the war, and then the time after the war just makes it fascinating. I feel like I got a whole different view of Germans, the Germans that didn't partake in the Nazi movement, and what life was like for them. And I loved every minute of the book. It's called All That I Am, and it's by Anna Funder. Another book that I just adored and that is a great summer read because it's very funny is The Spoiler by Annalena McAfee. Now, interestingly, I read on the back, she's married to Ian McEwan, so I guess we can expect a well-written book.
Yeah.
We know who edited it, right?
Right.
But it's an interesting premise. The main character, there are two main characters, and they're both journalists, and one was like a Martha Gellhorn kind of figure. She was a war correspondent, and she put her life in danger over and over again in war after war, Vietnam, Korea, and she was never into the sort of, glamorous part. She took journalism seriously. Truth was her god. And the woman who the other reporter works at a Murdoch-like paper and wants to expose the racy parts of this elder journalist's life. And so the interview is kind of a fencing match between these two. And the older woman is just brilliant. And you get from her why journalism matters, why it should matter. And from the younger journalism, you get the ambition and the race for the salacious. And it's not a nice commentary on journalism, but it is just a fabulous book to read. It's called The Spoiler, and it's by Annalena McAfee. And just along those lines, I'm not going to talk long, but I should tell you that Michael Frayen, who wrote Headlong, which is a very funny novel, has a book coming out in about 3 weeks called Skios, which is another really funny satire on, this time on academia. The third book I wanted to talk about is by William Boyd, and it's called Waiting for Sunrise. I've loved all of Boyd's books, and he never does the same thing twice. He's been shortlisted for the Booker many times. This, again, takes place this time in Vienna, but not right before. It starts in 1913. This young man, who's an actor, is having some sexual problems, some inadequacy. So he goes to Vienna to be analyzed, hoping this will help him. Well, in Vienna, he falls madly and passionately in love with with an artist who quickly solves his sexual problems. And just as quickly accuses him of rape and has him arrested.
Wow.
And so he goes, he escapes. Some people that he can't understand the reasons why help him escape. He goes back to England, and then not too many years after that, the war starts. And there's a spy element to this book. So again, it's just a great summer read. And again, very well written, although I'm sure Ian McEwan did not edit this one.
Waiting for Sunrise.
Right, by William Boyd.
Right. Ken Sanders.
Well, switching gears, Doug, Rumi was a 13th century Persian poet whose words endure with us to this day. Rumi was first publishing his philosophy and poetry and mysticism when, you know, twice as long ago as Shakespeare published his famous plays, and 250 years before the Bible was published. So Rumi has endured for some 800 years now. The local founder of the Rumi Poetry Club, Rasul Shams, has spent years translating from the original Rumi poems and has just published a new volume of translations of Rumi's poems. And I have just one really short parable I'd like to read to you. It's called The Aesthetic and His Beard. One day Rumi, with his disciples and students, having finished their prayers in a mosque, were walking toward downtown Konya. Suddenly an old man, an aesthetic with a long gray beard, came over to Rumi to pay his respects. Rumi embraced him and said, "Sir, are you older or your beard?" The monk answered, "Of course I am older, at least 20 years older than my beard." Rumi then said, "Woe to you! Your beard, which came much later than you, has grown naturally and become mature, but you still remain unripe in the darkness of your thought and ruining your own life." The monk joined the company of Rumi's disciples. There's a reason, I think, that this Persian mystic's poetry has endured all these centuries. On a local level, recently announced Utah Poet Laureate Lance Larson has a brand new collection of local poetry out called Backyard Alchemy.
It's great.
Highly recommended, a very deserving award. And the folks at Sugar House Review have come out with, I believe, their sixth semi-annual anthology of not just local poets, although this is a local publication, but literally poets from around the world. And they really, like the City Arts Program here in the city, you know, local poetry is a tough gig, and they've made it work, and they're putting it between covers. It's handsomely produced, and it contains some very fine work in it. And that's the recent poetry roundup, Doug.
Terrific. Great. Glad you did that. Okay, Catherine.
All right. My last big book, or my biggest book, is Capital by John Lanchester. And I don't think I've ever had my reading book, the book that we choose to read from, be a fiction title before, but this book really captivated me. He is such a skillful writer. There is a perceptual agility to Lanchester's writing that allows him to plumb the lives of his characters, the situations in which they find themselves, the city of London, with such depth and such grace that it really is a pleasure to read this book. The book is set in the city of London. Right now, basically, it's contemporary, and it's set on a road, Pepys Road, primarily, and the houses that are along there. This is a formerly middle class but now fairly wealthy neighborhood. It's gone through the transitions that a lot of London has gone through. Some of its residents are changing. Some of them are remaining the same, and all of them one morning wake up. And they receive a card, a postcard, with their mail that has a photograph of each of their houses. So each person has a card with his house on the front of it. And on the back of the card, it says, "We want what you have." And the book then pivots off of that through the lives of these characters. So you see what they have, what they don't have, or what they think they have, as well as all of the various capitals of London. The capital in capital is the city itself, money, because a lot of it does take place in the financial industry, but also the capital of every society, its people. And it really goes wonderfully into that. We couldn't find audio, so I'm going to read a brief bit here. To start this out, Petunia Howe, the oldest resident of Pepys Road, has fainted in the Pakistani grocery on the street, and Ahmed has helped her pick up. He is taking her home now. The day was clear and cold. The light was so bright that Ahmed had to hold up his hand to block it out when they crossed the road. He could feel Mrs. Howe's thinness. He could feel her trembling, either with cold or shock or fatigue or a little of all three. Petunia knew that he could feel her shaking and was also conscious that this was the first time she had touched a man other than her son-in-law and grandsons since Albert had died. For Ahmed, who felt that he was always in a rush, that any given day was at its heart an equation with too many tasks and too few minutes, the list of things to do never shrinking while the time in which to do things constantly contracted, there was something very strange about moving so slowly. It was like one of those exercises where they make people walk backwards or wear blindfolds in their own houses to make the familiar feel different. He could feel, he couldn't help himself, a wave of the irritation he felt so often at so many different things in the course of an ordinary day. At the same time, he managed to slow himself down and check the irritation by telling himself that there was no point in doing a good deed if all it did was make you feel bad-tempered. They reach the house. She says, "I'm fine from here." He goes to give her his number and write it down. "Let me write my telephone number down." He had a bureau but no paper and went to look for some in the scraps on the table beside the doorway next to the telephone. There were leaflets for pizza and curry. He took one up and wrote the number on the back. "I'll put it by the phone," he said. "Call." As he was replacing the leaflet on the table, he noticed that Petunia, too, had a card with a picture of her house on it. "We had one of those this morning," he said. "We want what you have." "At my age, nobody wants what you have," said Petunia. And Ahmed laughed. It's great. Called Capital, John Lanchester.
Terrific. Okay. So we're pretty much out of time. And so what we will do, because we always do this anyway, we didn't get to children's books or some other books, or what we call our lightning round. So we're going to finish things up here. We'll turn the mic back on, and as part of the sort of podcast extra, we'll include a few extra minutes in our conversations with Catherine Willer from Willer Bookworks at Trolley Square, Betsy Burton from the King's English at 15th and 15th in Salt Lake, Ken Sanders, who owns Ken Sanders Rare Books on 2nd East in Salt Lake. Thank you to you all for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
Thanks, Doug.
And again, a list of the books mentioned on the program available on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Well, we're just going to jump back in. It's Doug Fabrizio here again with Catherine Willer, Betsy Burton, and Ken Sanders. And this is what we're going to call our lightning round, although we're going to start with children's books. And let's just Ken, you want to start?
Sure. I'm going to do one of my favorites. Fantagraphics is probably the currently greatest publisher of comic art, comic strips, graphic novels, and all things visual. And most of it doesn't. A lot of it is more adult or older teenager or, you know, young adult type material, but they've just started doing a new reprinting of all the classic Carl Barks's Disney stories. Mm. Carl Barks, of course, was the unsung Disney artist who, like all the other artists that worked for Disney, got the Walt Disney byline instead of Carl Barks. But even children could tell when a Donald Duck story was written and drawn by Carl Barks or not, because the ones that weren't Barks stunk it up. And even a little kid could tell the difference.
Yeah.
And they are just starting with their – and now – and even though Walt Disney did, in fact, create most of the Duck families, Carl Barks created my favorite duck, Uncle Scrooge, the duck, the rich duck that loved money for the sheer exhilaration of it. He had a gigantic money bin that he would dive like a porpoise into all the bills and the silver and the gold coins. And he just loved the vicarious nearness of it all. He just loved, and it just, you got to admire a guy that has that kind of non-greed love of money. So Fantagraphics is publishing. And imagine me holding the book here, because it's one of these phantom books that hasn't quite come out yet.
Yeah.
It's big, beautiful, all in four color, Only a Poor Old Man, which introduces Karl Barks' finest creation, Uncle Scrooge, to the Walt Disney public, and one of my favorite cartoon characters of all time.
Terrific. Great. Betsy.
Okay, my first book is Sophie's Fish by local author Ann Cannon, and it is about a little boy who quickly promises that he will take care of Sophie's fish while she's out of town, and he doesn't really think. He just says, oh, sure. And then he starts to worry. I mean, you know, what if he forgets to do something that he should be doing and something happens to the fish? Or what if the fish turns out to be a shark and something happens to him? And his imagination runs completely wild for many, many pages. And then in the end, somebody knocks on the door and he thinks he'll say, nobody's here, but he opens the door a crack and it's Sophie. And she says, hi, I'm here with my fish in my little green wagon. And she says, you just have to feed it twice a day. And he says, is that all? And then that is the end of the story. He takes care very happily of Sophie's fish. And he says, it'll be a snap. And in the end, he says, or not.
Who did the illustrations?
Oh, it's illustrated by Lee White. And funnily enough, the publishers match people up. But this illustrator is actually from Utah. It was a total accident.
Wow. Terrific.
Then a chapter book that I loved is called Wonder by R.J. Palacio, I guess. And it's about a boy who, for the first time in fifth grade, goes to school. He's never gone before. He's been homeschooled because his face, he has a syndrome, and his face is in parts. He's just, you know, he's not at all, quote, normal looking. And he's terrified to go to school. And this is, unlike books like The Elephant Man that deal with this in a very dark way, this is a book about a class learning to be kind. Mm. And it isn't easy for him and it isn't easy for them. But it's a very compassionate book and it has a wonderful, lippy, quick dialogue with several voices of the kids that are involved in this fifth grade class. And it's always wonderful when an adult adores a kid's book.
Yeah.
You know it works on every level. And this really is a book that works on every level.
Great. Say the name.
Wonder by R.J. Palacio. And then the last one is called Codename Verify by Elizabeth Wine. And this is a thriller, and honestly, you can read it on an adult level. It's a young woman who, they're two best friends who both know how to fly. Well, one is actually a pilot, the other one isn't. But they're both very good at things of war. And one of them gets captured, and she is interrogated by a Nazi. And the only thing she knows how to do is tell stories. So she lies. She lies her way through weeks of interrogation. And it is a riveting book. I couldn't put it down. It's very well written. And the friendship between these two young women is very touching. Codename Verity by Elizabeth Wine.
Great.
Okay, my first one is the Chuck Close Facebook. This is a really cool book because Chuck Close is really cool. He's a modern artist who makes large, large-scale portraits that hang in many museums worldwide. He gets a lot of questions from kids. His art is captivating for all ages. So this is a book that he wrote for kids. And the fun thing about it is, in the middle of it, it's one of those books where you can flip the pages are cut into threes. So you can flip through them and make your own portrait based on his portraits. The other part of the book, the serious part of the book, is answering the questions that he gets asked by kids all the time. So this is great for classrooms exploring the artistic process, but also for kids who are really artsy and want to explore art in a really fun way, because Chuck Close does keep this fun. It doesn't become overly didactic. Do you ever make paintings on paper? Why doesn't anyone in your art smile? It's a valid question. Why are your paintings so big? It's a wonderful book. Absolutely fantastic. And Chuck Close did it. So it has his stamp of approval, or
I love
else
the title,
he's a fool.
Facebook. That's so
yes.
Great.
Next is Hippoposites by Janik Coate. This is a board book. It's a concept book. And it uses a hippo to explore the concepts, large, small, light, heavy. But it gets into the kind of sophisticated ones as well. Opaque, transparent,
nice.
Positive, negative, clear, blurry. In the back, it gets a little touchy-feely. There are some things you can feel. Goes into left, right, and alone and together at the very end. It has very simple graphics to explain sometimes strange concepts for kids, mm-hmm. but concepts kids inherently understand, such as free and caged. It's a great book to just sit and look at with a kid, but it also has some kind of taking off points that can be pretty interesting too. Hippopposites by Janik Coate. Last one is Pete the Cat and His Four Groovy Buttons. Now, I like Pete the Cat because he's a snappy dresser and he has a devil-may-care attitude. And I like this book because it teaches kids to say groovy. And I think groovy is a good word to introduce to kids.
That sounds like Fritz the Cat to me.
Almost. Pete this time has a fantastic new sweater that has lots of buttons. He loves it. But alas, his buttons begin popping off. And you get a little math lesson involved. 4 - 1 = 3. He has 3 buttons left. But the best lesson of all is, as all of his buttons are popping off on the way to the beach, he's unflappable. He's just really not that upset by losing all of his buttons. Did Pete cry? Goodness, no. Buttons come and buttons go. Pete looked down at his buttonless shirt, and what do you think he saw? His belly button. So he still had one. And at the end, That's he's great. Just surfing away, digging on his belly button.
Yeah. So you don't want to lose that one.
The good
it's
kind
a
of
great
navel
book.
Gazing, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Great. That's terrific. Okay, so we've got like 2 minutes left, so let's just bounce through as many as possible. Ken.
Okay, I'm going to stick with the visual and comic books today. I'm just reverting that way. This is The Mysterious Traveler, a collection of pre-code horror stories by Steve Ditko, another one of my great comic book artist inspirations. There's a photograph of the elusive Mr. Ditko himself and just a couple of splash pages of the flavor of his horror and sci-fi art from the pre-code horror days of the 1950s. This magazine is haunted, and there's one other here.
Is he still alive?
He is. He's very elderly, and he's become increasingly politicized and very, very Ayn Randian.
Hmm.
Well, but he's still my hero.
Okay. At least for now, right?
I forgive you, Steve.
Okay. Great. Okay, say the name again.
Tales of the Mysterious Traveler.
Terrific. Okay. Betsy.
Okay. I'm doing paperbacks, and this, although this is a hardback, it's out in paper tomorrow. Yeah, the Cat's it. Table, Michael Ondaatje. Mm. It's just a great read. 3 boys running feral on a ship for 2 weeks. What they see and what they misunderstand. It's just a great read and a brilliant book.
What Money Can't Buy by Michael J. Sandel. I love Sandel and his philosophies. This one is subtitled The Moral Limit of Markets. And in a time when we are very much talking about market economies and how much of our world they should run, this is a really good book to read to explore how far one should want to take markets in a civil society.
We're trying to get him, by the way.
Good.
We had him for justice, and he's
coming
for which is an amazing.
He's coming for the Tanner lectures.
Yeah,
oh, is he?
Yes.
Oh, there you go. Okay. Yep. All right, let's do one more really quick. Ken,
Katie Lee. She's a 92-year-old former singer, folk singer, Glen Canyon environmental activist. I don't know of a lot of 92-year-olds that go on tour with a brand new book called "The Ballad of Gutless Ditch." And charges $75 for a fine press limited edition version of it. Wow. With custom illustrations. Katie is absolutely amazing. I don't know where she gets the energy from. We flew her up here for the gig, but she insisted that I drive her back home to Jerome, which I did. And I wished I'd had the presence of mind to have recorded that conversation. Yeah. The stories she told me about meeting Harry Belafonte in the civil rights era in 1955 in New York are just absolutely priceless.
Wow.
And she still rides her bicycle around the streets of Jerome at 92.
Oh, great. Betsy.
I hope I'm like that.
Yeah, me too.
3 weeks in December, another paperback that I loved. It's got two plots running simultaneously, one about a young man who goes to Africa at the turn of the last century because he doesn't fit in. He's gay and he doesn't fit in. And the lions start eating one by one all the people as they're building a bridge. So there's this involvement with animals. And then at the turn of this century, a young woman with really Asperger's who falls in love with the bonobos, when she's doing a scientific experience. It's a gripping read, and it says lots of interesting things about identity, and I loved it.
Terrific.
3 weeks in December, Audrey Shulman.
Hey, this is the polar opposite of What Money Can't Buy. Understanding Objectivism, A Guide to Learning Ayn Rand's Philosophy, lectures by Leonard Peikoff. If you are in love with Ayn Rand because you've read The Fountainhead or Atlas Shrugged and you are beginning to fancy yourself as a Randian kind of thinker, it would behoove you to delve deeper into her philosophy and see really what she's talking about and what she thinks. This is a very cogent set of lectures that walks one through what objectivism is, what Rand was talking about, and what she believes.
And you may change your mind.
You may. You may not. But at least you'll know what it is she's espousing.
Kat, did you say Randy or Randism?
Take your pick.
Catherine Weller, Betsy Burton, Ken Sanders. Thanks, guys, very much.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you.